Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 101. This is Jamie Russo. I own a co-working space in Palo Alto, California. I am also the executive director of the Global Workspace Association and the founder of Everything Coworking. It has been a super busy start to the new year. If you are a regular listener, I have missed a couple of weeks. I try not to do that, but the end of the year, beginning of the year, and special projects have kind of gotten the best of me. So I kicked off January after the holiday with putting in some new offices and meeting room using the Imagispace project. And if you're a regular listener, you've probably heard me talk about that project, but it was a great way to kind of optimize our product mix. We have constant demand for team spaces and meeting space. And Imagispace is a really flexible option for building material, so it's considered to be furniture. So I'm going to do a full debrief of that project on an upcoming episode, so I won't spend a lot of time on it here. But as you can imagine, you think a project's going to be pretty straightforward, but there are a lot of details involved and a lot of moving pieces to coordinate, so that took a lot of time. And I have a community manager that is out, so I am in the hiring process, which also takes up time. But I will share what I learn, which is always a part of the fun and the journey. Speaking of which, today's topic is around credit card processing fees. Maybe not the sexiest topic we could cover, but I bet it's one that comes up for you. If you are a new operator, you may not have seen the pain of your line item for credit card fees every month as your recurring revenue starts to increase. But if you are an operator and you have a space or two and your monthly recurring revenue has started to increase, that credit card fee line item starts to add up pretty quickly. You're probably paying credit card fees between 2 and 4%. And if you take that off of your revenue, then you're in the hundreds to thousands of dollars a month in credit card fees, which starts to feel a little bit painful as you look at your P&L and look for ways to both add to the top line and then watch your expense items. So I was hosting one of my flight group sessions last month, and one of the flight group members wanted to start encouraging her members to make ACH payments, which is a payment made directly from a bank account from a member's bank account into your bank account. You have to initiate that process, and wondered if she could encourage that by passing credit card fees on to members so that they'd have to pay the fee if they chose to pay by credit card, and how would members respond to that, et cetera. I was immediately hesitant because I know that in California, where I am, there are some laws that prevent you, depending on what type of business you run, from passing along fees. And I've tried to set up ACH payments myself and struggled with getting my bank to give me approval to do that. So we started kind of talking through the ins and outs and Googling about laws. And I finally said, I will take this topic as homework and get some answers. And instead of just taking this back to the flight group as an answer, I thought, why don't I make it available to the full group and share it on the podcast? So we're going to dive in. But speaking of which, I do have a couple of spots open in my in-flight group program, which is for operators that are already running a space. It is for you if you are looking for a group to help you grow your business and help you figure out next steps if you're thinking about expanding, or you have a space and you're, you know, looking for marketing support, looking for programming support, looking to share your best practices with others, and generally create a community of people and resources that you can draw from to create community and enjoy your process a little bit more and also run your business better. Lots of details online if you'd like some more information. No opt-in or anything. You can just go and read the details at www.everythingcoworking.com/flight group. Okay. Now let's jump into today's interview. I am excited today to be joined by Jack Richer, who is the executive lead for PlacePay, and I will let him talk in detail about what PlacePay is. So I met Jack because PlacePay is a GWA member, and since joining, he has been super engaged in the industry and constantly offering to help and give advice on helping us kind of advance our cause. And he just joined us as a GWA advisory board member. So we're super excited to sort of formally be able to call him and ask him for his opinions on things and his perspective on the industry. And he has an interesting background, which he'll share in a minute. But I thought of Jack because, and I told him, I don't always have, he would be considered kind of a vendor in the industry. And I'm always careful about having them on the podcast. But in one of my recent flight group calls, we started talking about credit card fees and how to manage them. And all of a sudden we're on Google looking for what are the laws in states about passing fees on and avoiding fees. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to take this as homework and I'm going to get us some answers. And I thought I can get Jack to tell me the scoop live on a podcast. So Jack, thank you for joining us today.
Jamie, thanks for having me. This is a pleasure. And just speaking for my colleagues and I, quite a happy accident that we were asked to get involved with the Workspace project, because we have found, while it's still a rapidly growing niche industry, the people that comprise this industry are just fantastic. And we have loved working with everyone, particularly GWA and the GWA core. So an honor and servitude to join the advisory board. And thanks for putting value on my acumen.
I forget what a fun group of people we are. That's one of the things that I love about the industry too. Okay, so tell us a little bit about your background and then PlacePay so that we can sort of set some context for our detailed list of questions that we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is in residential real estate and the built world, if you will. We have so much RE tech coming up and cool buzzwords like 10X as for tenant experience, that it has made the world of real estate get its own moniker of the built world, since there's an exploding corner of it that's all made of bits opposed to bricks. And while I really enjoyed working in residential, after getting close to well more than a half decade in, what I enjoyed most is that first nascent look at advanced web technologies for real estate. I got to be a beta tester for the first cloud platform for property management services. And I was pretty crazy, you know, just the idea of not having a server in your office that was only available to access from somewhere on the floor. So this stuff started moving at a rapid clip, and I was one of the earliest on that platform to take advantage of any payment gateway services. And then I thought it was so efficient that we did an initiative to migrate everyone to either in person, meaning like checks or certified checks, or electronic payments, because it did away with the number one friction point, which is some sort of mail lag or other type of handoff mechanism of delay. And then people saying, oh, well, I didn't deserve the late fee. And they're like, well, this is the day we got it. It's a bad conversation. So when I was looking for a new challenge, I was kind of talking to everyone who's in the working on RE tech projects in New York, I came across i3 Verticals division at the time named Rentshare, which is i3 Verticals is one of the country's largest payment providers in many different verticals, but the real estate division then named Rentshare, now named PlacePay. And I'll explain why the name was changed, because it totally relates to servicing the workspace industry. Chatted with them and they're like, whoa, wait. When did you guys get involved with electronic payments for real estate? And I was like, just before the market crashed, we kept pushing on it. And they're like, so you think you can teach people the virtues of this? I'm like, yeah, absolutely I can. So much more efficient. Like, this is a much better way to approach a very critical operational aspect. The rest is kind of history. I don't miss the built world too much, but I do find myself staring up at the skyscrapers in New York and fascinated what developers are doing.
And you're still sort of, right, adjacently related. And right, so you're in New York. And one thing I love about Jack's background is that he has a degree in both economics and the dramatic arts, which I think is such a fantastic combination. So you're like a creative nerd.
Yeah, does satisfy the two competing sides of my personality.
Totally. I love that. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about specifically what PlacePay, how they function in the marketplace, both in general and then as it relates to shared workspace.
Yep. So the reason why we changed it to PlacePay is because rent is a legal term and it relates to a formal lease agreement, which is a special division of civil court in most jurisdictions, meaning states. So saying rent to support anything other than an actual long-form lease agreement that would be subject to the rules, precedents, and statutes right. of landlord-tenant court, special civil division, doesn't really fit well. And it was causing a little bit of nervousness, starting with when we got into HOA for condos when I first joined up with I3. But once we made the workspace introduction, it was every single operator that we spoke to said, this sounds like a great idea for my business. I would like take advantage of it. Like, how do I tell people about the rent aspect? And we're like, we pivoted to payments for places, so place pay. And through a couple sort of mutual connections, we were introduced to car workplaces, and they were running up against the problem that you mentioned, the onset of the calls, that various states have very specific statutes on their books regarding credit cards as a service fee. Sometimes it's referred to as a convenience fee. Sometimes it's referred to as a surcharge, but the compliance for this varies quite a bit state to state. And they were looking for guidance and a solution to do what everyone else in real estate does. When I say everyone else, I'm specifically referring to residential HOA, so residential rentals, HOA. And if there is a CRE, like a smaller space CRE that's taking cards, it is extremely, extremely rare that any landlord is covering the cost of credit card processing, because it, you know, it can be somewhere between a little over 2% to close to 4% of the transaction value. So when you're talking about rent, really high ticket of thousands or potentially tens of thousands, when you get into commercial real estate, these are huge numbers, starting with a mild, you know, $50 to $100 or a couple grand to hundreds of dollars. And think of that as a large scale, like this is not scalable for an individual operator.
Just to jump in to clarify real quick. So cars looking at their P&Ls and saying, across our 28 locations or whatever they have, we're spending millions of dollars every month on credit card fees. And we don't like that. What legally?
It wasn't every month. It was a big number.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking to about car specifically anymore, but when you look at a traditional flex office operator, when I say traditional, I mean very heavy on the permanent offices,
yep.
lighter on the ancillary services, meaning virtual mail, one-off conference room bookings, people drop in day passes or co-working, when the vast lion's share of your organization's revenue is from the longer term member who has an office or a permanent space, and you're letting all of them pay on card when yep. they pass you in the hall every day, that is a substantial amount of money that's going to a third party. The credit card brands, when they're not adding too much value to that relationship, there's a small amount of convenience, to be certain. And typically someone in that scenario gets some points or some
right.
miles, which I'm sure,
I'm
sure they appreciate. But for what it cost the operator, honestly, they could start their own, you know, like hopefully no one from the industry is listening, but for what it cost the operator, they could launch their own loyalty program for right. a lot less.
Right. I mean, yeah, for anybody listening, I mean, we have an open office that's $2,400 a month. It's a 6-person office. You know, if we pay 3% on that, it's $72 a month. To your point, like, that's a lot of the way more than the value in points that that person is getting. But there are a lot of challenges in terms of, right, how do we get rid of that? So Carr came to you and said, yeah, what are our options here to start to reduce that fee that we're paying every month?
Yeah, they had been looking for some expertise on that for a little bit. I got connected to them and we talked it through. And then the rest of it was about systemizing. And just to be clear for anyone who's listening, by card brand rules, you are not allowed to steer people away in any circumstance from using a card for any sort of perk whatsoever. That is a no-no. So I was just being illustrative of the economic is like, but the norm is in real estate, and this is going back quite a while for residential and traditional CRE, is to not accept cards. And if you do, then it is a service fee on top to the payor. And the serviced office industry, because Jim, you probably know more about this, it might have got some of its origins from more of a holdover temp space. It's sort of like a hoteling, that it's been very heavily card usage, whereas now it's often first preference for an office solution, the point of where the head of real estate for Verizon has mentioned a couple of times that anytime they're looking at space for any team, they always evaluate the serviced office or the flex office options within the desired geography as well. It's just automatic that they do. And they said that the coin toss on that is they're often going with the serviced office solution for the flexibility, for the culture of the employees or the team that will be based there. A lot of reasons that go that direction. I think that's interesting, but that tells you where the mentality is on the buy side, is that this is not just a viable alternative. It's often the preferred platform for an employee workspace.
Yeah, and we'll start to see more of that. I think, right, your example with Verizon, they're very forward-looking and have their own co-working brand, but yeah, completely agree. So tell us more about credit card fees.
And you'd asked me about this right before we got on the podcast, which is, well, the alternative to, as far as electronic payments go, the most major alternative, ACH, which is the automated clearinghouse, which is the modern day equivalent of the original check clearing system for the U.S. banking system. So it used to be that checks would go someplace centralized and they'd get processed and it would be done in regional system. Regionally, physical check would need to go to the region where the draw upon bank is. That gave way to the automated clearinghouse, which is ACH, which is how most people receive their payroll if they're W-2 at this point. And it works really well when you have a reoccurring customer, like someone paying a monthly rent or a monthly licensing fee, as it so happens in most flex office scenario. The challenge is when you're small, is getting a good ACH facility at a reasonable price with the limits that you need to process all your revenues, and then also getting that information into whatever accounting or ERP system you have to square out your accounts receivable. So it's a several part ask. And that was when I said, like, cards provided an additional convenience. Cards overcame that quite easily. But if you tried to go down to your local bank, and it doesn't matter if it's savings and loan or a community bank, credit union, or one of the more major national associations, Citi, Chase, Wells, et cetera, if you're a small business, what they would consider small business by economics, it's going to be tough to get ACH facilities to start with. You're going to pay a good monthly fee. There's probably going to be some limits and some holds on it. And you're still going to be, you're responsible for manually getting that data in, and you have to manage it too. So it's basically like a list. You want to think about bill pay list. It's the reverse. It's an accounts receivable list.
Right.
And you're hitting those people's accounts. And question very flatly that you put to me is, why is this difficult?
Yeah, I mean, to jump in really quickly, I remember telling you, like, I can't remember what all the no's were, but I remember my bank is Chase, and calling Chase repeatedly and trying to get somebody on the phone who would help me do this for my business. And the answer was just, I couldn't get to a yes. So we had never done it. So that was one of my first questions, right? Why is this so hard? So
the reason is, this is a personal assessment, but the reason why it's harder to get an ACH facility than merchant services is because the risk reward, the yield on it for the bank is far, far less, but the risk is far, far higher. So they're usually looking for people with financial backgrounds that have some sophistications and understand that there's a lot of compliance from NACHA, which is the governing body that oversees the ACH network, and that they understand that those rules are actually different than PCI or the payment card industry, and that you get that there's liability that you're assuming if you're given the facilities to debit somebody else's account. That's far different than trying to do ACH origination, which is what payroll is, and you're pushing money into your employee's account with their sign-off. You get put in their HR packet, you're getting a sign-off that says, yeah, you can go ahead and
put money into my account. And, to your point, that's different than take money out of my account every month. Mm-hmm.
And the big difference with how our system works for the NACHA compliance is that we're actually asking, at the core of it, is we're actually asking the account holder, which would be the workspace member or the workspace client, if you'd like to to have the money come out of your bank account, please enter that information, confirm that it is accurate, and confirm that you give authorization to your base provider to run that debit if it's an auto pay, or if you don't give permission for that as a reoccurring, that it's just a one time and you set the, you pick the amount. So we're putting a lot of that in the hands of the account holder to direct. Whereas if you got it from your bank does not have the tools to let all these people, all your customers, go to some sort of portal, some customer portal, and input their routing and account and instruct what the permissions are. The closest thing they have is online bill pay, but that still often generates a printed check that goes through the traditional mail, unless some enterprise real estate shops have signed up for what's called the Billers Network, but that's a whole other can of worms that we'll stay away from.
Yeah, the lack of the interface makes complete sense. So, okay, so you just kind of answered my first couple of questions. Why is this so hard? And can I just, you know, do this with my local bank? And then, so can you, just for people who are listening who maybe aren't running a space yet or don't, so we kind of talked about this a little bit, like what's the difference between the customer-facing payment portal and then a payment processor? So the place where like a customer can log in and actually pay, I think there are some people who don't sort of know what that workflow looks like. Can you kind of walk through that a little bit?
Yeah. And since Carr was kind enough to, you know, help bring us into this industry and be great advocates of ours, make the introduction to you, Jamie, and give us a white paper, let me just keep using that origin story. So Carr Workplaces has a commercial off-the-shelf platform called Operate by Ascensus. This is not a shameless plug. This is just actually what happened. So they have this commercial software, right? It's available to anyone who wants to buy it and use it for their space. Now, the data that's used to make payments is high-value data, right? It's when you ever hear about breaches in the newspapers, they're talking about they went after the credit card information and some related customer data points, such as billing or shipping addresses and stuff like that. But it's often the core of it is they went after the payment methods. So when you talk about the payment interface, the member, the client of the workspace is logging into the portal that's provided by software, whether it's an office shelf solution that's commercially available, or the operator has commissioned developers to build something special just for them. It's a bespoke solution. The high value data is what's entered into that payment field, but some of the most high value data. So what we do with our partners, our software partners, is we provide a payment module that lives inside of their software. So when a member or a client goes to manage their relationship, which includes invoicing and payments, the payment stuff is all happening natively on our servers. So it cuts everyone else out of the data security protocols. And it also allows us to do an tokenization. So as that stuff's getting entered in on the user's web page, we're scraping away the high value raw data and we're tokenizing it, which means encryption. So it travels encrypted, it's stored encrypted, much, and there's no actually like, say, credit card numbers on the system. So that helps everyone maintain best practices and also removes them as a potential target for a data breach, which is great because going back to the old on-site system, if you're taking or if you're using a very terrible e-commerce checkout, you're going to have all that payment method payload on your website or on your web servers. Or if you're using a commercial system that's off the shelf, that, you know, it's plug and play, you just set it up and use it, and they're storing it. Now they're a target, and then they need to engage best practices and PCI compliance and everything that has to do with data security, data management, scanning. But the way we have it configured, it never goes through anyone else's hands. So this is the intended architecture so that we can know that we have end security covered from when the member or client first starts populating the form all the way through. And then any transactions that are run is just a reference token that's instructed to our system that says, my name is Jack Richer, but my reference token would be about 27 characters. That's all a jumble of letters and numbers. Looks nothing like Jack Richer.
Right. Okay, so keep going with the example, because I think I want to make this like super, super silly clear for everybody. So car takes a variety of, so let's keep using the car example. So pre-PlacePay, they took lots and lots of cards, probably some checks. And were they doing any ACH on their own?
They were, and it was working just as I had mentioned earlier, which is they had to maintain the list that got submitted once a month to their bank, told them what was successful and what was failed, and then it was their responsibility to get that into their accounting platform, and then anything that didn't work, you know, contact the account holder.
Yep, chasing things around. Okay, got it. So, and then any credit card they were taking, they're paying, you know, 2-4% in fees. So insert PlacePay into their Ascensus-based management platform. What changes?
So what changes is three things. One is data security. Two is ownership over compliance. And three is the cost structure. And they all relate to the architecture of our system. When I say data security, we deliberately have kept the data from flowing through car systems or the software systems they use. So it goes directly to us and our servers that we have, you know, payment experts that take care of. So that's the first thing. Also in there is compliance. When you don't have high value data related to payments flowing through your systems, it takes a lot out of scope. The thing that people think of that know best is PCI scope. So it takes an incredible amount out of scope. The impression I don't want to give here is if they have any desktop terminals that don't relate to us or anything else they're doing that's outside of our ecosystem, there's definitely scope for that. And that is particular to those devices. But as far as our services related to managing a PlacePay wallet or paying your rent or licensing fee for your workspaces or any real estate that you pay through us, so we handle the compliance for both parties because it's built into our architecture and for the platform that's being used, the actually delivers the web page. So the separation between the payment interface and the biggest part of what we do is all behind the scenes and is all in our architecture. Mm-hmm. And if you want to think of it like a picture in picture, you're going to hit a payment form and the little thing where you're actually doing the typing, that's us, that's our servers, and the rest of the page is hosted by somebody else.
Yep.
And that's just so that we can get the data flow in the most optimal fashion for the reduced scope and that we can take cheap ownership over the compliance. And the last thing is that the way that we have our architecture, we have a 50-state compliant from a legalities perspective on a service fee for credit cards. That's really important. So across the country, there are a lot of different states with different rules about, when I say rules, I mean laws about
passing along fees.
They call it different
California,
things, surcharging, adding yeah. fees. Yeah, there's all sorts of things that basically said you can't have two-tiered pricing for cards versus cash or any other payment method. They change from state to state. But the important thing here is that the way architecture is set up is that it's 50 state compliant with all those statutes. And the reason is because it's totally our fee. And this is the same as how it works if you're trying to pay taxes online with a card, tuition, it's the same architecture that goes behind Ticketmaster. If you ever bought a concert ticket online and you're paying a service fee to them that you wouldn't pay if you walked into the box office in person and bought it. And the reality is that when we deliver our cards as a service fee program for a workspace operator or anyone else in real estate, 100% of that surcharge is retained with us, and we take care of paying the card networks. One penny ever touches a bank account or any other properties, financial or otherwise, of the operator. That's the big difference. It's never their fee. It's always our fee. They're not involved. We're just a third party authorized partner. And it's non-obligatory. No one ever has to use us for a card payment. I mean, no one ever has to use us and no one has to make a card payment. So it's totally voluntary. It's a convenience feature offered by the real estate operator.
So if I'm a member of CAR, what are my payment options and fee structures for those today?
If you're a member of CAR, they offer quite a number of payment options. Can't speak to whether they accept cash, but I don't know that they don't. You can do an online bill pay. They'll get a check in the mail. You can do check in person. They provide for Fedwire, which is a wire transfer that's a bank to bank, takes like 60, 90 minutes, whatever. They accept that. They provide information on how to do that. And then if you're using the portal, you can make an ACH payment, which is free to the payor, the member, the client. or, and that routes through us. And you're welcome to use a card, which again, also routes through us, processed by us, which there is a flat rate charge for from us, 2.9%, I believe.
Okay. So they're, so using, having PlacePay integrated into their portal and having the payments flow directly to PlacePay and not to anybody else, meaning the payment all happens on your side from a legal perspective, allows that fee to be passed along. And that's true in 50 states.
Yep. So the fee is totally ours. No one else is involved in that fee. We pay the card networks directly what they're owed in the originating bank, you know, the card issuing bank. So we pay all that directly. CAR is not involved and no one else is involved. And then we post the payment data into their accounting platform. And that's the same for ACH. But ACH is free for the client. So
right.
Convenient way to use their bank account. The other options are got to hand a check or...
Could show up with your pile of cash, your suitcase.
I don't know for a fact whether they take piles
totally,
of cash.
Totally. No, I would not take cash. No, thank you. Yeah. Please come back.
Yeah, I cannot speak to whether the car accepts cash. I have trouble imagining that they want people to go in arrears if they're standing there with cash and they're like, well, this is what I have today.
Right.
I don't know what their policy is. I don't know what their policy is.
Yeah, most of us don't
know. Maybe they'll say
cash,
there's a money order place around the corner.
Right. Exactly. Okay. But so this is important because you facilitate the ability to incent ACH payments and disincent credit card fees. And you've saved CAR at this point a pile of money. We probably can't disclose the exact amount on credit card fees across their 28-ish locations.
Yeah, well, I can quote their Ashley Bruckner, who's their operational lead. And last time she mentioned aloud in a public forum, she said it was way more than seven figures. And I'm willing to stand by that.
Totally. Yeah. Which is amazing. So, I mean, if you're just opening, these credit card fees have probably not started to pile up and look appalling yet. But if your monthly recurring revenue is starting to build, or you're moving on to location number two or three, then yeah, I mean, they always say, you know, you don't want to save your way to profitability. But in our business, where margins are tight-ish, you know, you're looking for opportunities to optimize things. And this is sort of the seamless way to make it happen. I mean, even for a CAR who probably can, to your point, you know, sort of go to their bank and get this done more easily than those of us with one or two locations, this is the easy flow for them. And it's automated, right? They don't have to do anything manually because everything happens through your portal. What if an ACH payment fails through your portal? What happens then?
It's all automated. Everything posts and notifies the appropriate parties, both in the ledger system and also to the operational team on their end. And then it's a matter of just looking at what the notice is. The ACH network provides a reason code.
Yep.
We provide the explanation what that reason code is. So whatever next steps are for the appropriate situation, if the account is underfunded, then they need to talk to their client and say, hey,
right.
When is the account going to be properly funded?
That awkward conversation. Totally.
But I mean, because if the account has been frozen for security reasons, then they need to have that conversation instead.
Yeah. But the good news is generally it's automated and the second tries and whatever come from your platform. And there's not the sort of manual placing the accounts receivable order through the bank. So, and you integrate with some of the platforms. Can you talk about that a little bit? Yeah.
Yeah. We integrate with several of the popular platforms in the US. We don't endorse one or another because we like them all, but we do also welcome new integrations, both bespoke, so one-off, and commercial partnerships. So whether it's if you're an operator and you're building your own tenant experience, it is very tough in this country to find real estate payment processing that works through APIs. Everywhere else you go that you can get API payment processing, you're going to run into all sorts of underwriting complications and limits. So you're not going to get the services that you're truly desiring, which is be able to run your receivables on the due date at the volumes that you're hoping to aspire to. And if you do find the limits you're looking for, it's very unlikely that it's an API-based system that works well with the modern tools that you're constructing for all real-time syncing. So we have numerous operators in the U.S. that hooked into us directly, and that's wonderful. And we have several commercial platforms that have and others that are looking at it.
And a commercial platform, just so we're using super clear terminology, because I said platform generically, which could be anything. So like an Ascensus, an office R&D, a proximity space, a One Systems, like I'm being outdated now, yeah. Yardi Cube, any of those platforms. Yeah. So how difficult are those integrations?
If you're your own operator and you've commissioned, and it usually happens when you're talking about a space that's at scale, an operator at scale, like they've got internal resources to manage a technology product that they've custom built and the resources to commission that product in the first place. So an integration can be done in a couple days. Worst I've seen, a couple days of work. The worst I've seen is a little more than a week. And this is an actual effort.
Is that for a custom system versus off the shelf, like an Ascensus or Office R&D?
It's both.
Okay.
The commercial systems, meaning software that's commercially available, off the shelf, they tend to have a lot. They tend to be more feature rich and customizable. So those are a bit more complicated because they try and build their systems to accommodate many, many different operational protocols of real estate. Whereas someone who's built something themselves, it's totally tailored to a very narrow feature set for their operational procedures.
Makes sense.
So much simpler system. Okay. Typically.
So you need to have a developer resource to get this done, but a couple days, worst case a week. And that ROI comes down the road when you're passing along those credit card fees.
Yeah. And to go back to the ROI, we did some surveying of the workspace industry. And what we found is, of course, the cost per desk changes quite a bit when you move from coastal inland. But what we found is that if you're looking at a space that's between 15,000 square foot and 20,000 square foot, that it is very common for your annual payment processing costs to be between $20,000 and
$30,000. Okay, got it. It's a great benchmark. That's really helpful. That's a big number. put that developer
once you get up to several.
Yeah.
Now that we're headed into, not all businesses are on the same tax year as personal income taxes, but many are because of pass-through entities. Now we're headed into tax preparation season. I would not be surprised, as if it happens in previous years, where a number of owners call me like, hey, I just got my taxes back from my accountant to sign, and I saw this expense line item. What can I do?
Right. Exactly. Good. So, yeah, you're like,
I can't believe I gave that away.
Right. Exactly. Okay. What else, speaking of people calling you, what have I not asked you that other operators would ask about this process or what they need to know?
The biggest thing that people want to understand is compliance and limits, and then also integrations. So let me just take those one at a time. The compliance thing is, and as operators become more seasoned and they grow, there's usually becomes an in-house expert on these things. And when it comes to compliance, and you've kind of learned some of this stuff, find that a lot of people learn some of this stuff the hard way because they weren't coached. We're big believers on helping our clients tackle the educational curve, engaging best practices. And it could be something as simple as if you're not performing your compliance correctly, that someone disputes a charge and you lose that dispute. So now you're out that money. You have to find some other way to recoup what you thought you had already booked as revenue. The worst case scenario is you have a breach, cybersecurity breach, and you were storing high value information. And now you have a real liability on your hands. Some forms of business insurance help. Some forms don't. Can't really speak too much further on that, but the best position to be in is to not have that risk in the first place. And the last thing is that not all systems are created equal. So it's pretty common for people to go like, oh, I have this and I got something that's working. Like, do you have it and it's working properly? Do you have the processing limits that you need? Do you have people who have real backgrounds and understand your business and your industry, and do you get all your funding, meaning your payments, within a very reasonable amount of time, such as 2 banking days? It's really important that you get your cash flow and that you have the least amount of PCI scope, you have the least amount of compliance burden, that you have expertise to turn to, And when it comes to data security, that you have the least amount of burden there too, because that's potentially your real liability should you ever be, your systems ever be a victim or a target. So that's the stuff that people ask a lot about, is trying to understand what kind of risks are involved with the intangible, the what-ifs.
Yep.
And some of them occur much more obviously, which is they grow or they get a really big, they grow and they've overcome their limits, their processing limits, and then they're getting very frustrated because of funding delays, or they just can't get transactions done, or they sign a really big client. And again, same problem. And they thought it was going to be a great thing. And now there's this logistical hurdle about how do we get the big client to pay when they rented so much space from us, when you're looking for your cash. Having people who are specialized in payments for real estate and know the Workspace Association in particular really helps when you, an operator, have something that you're trying to achieve for your business. So you can turn to someone who gets it.
Right. And you play that role. So, right. As people are, to your point, sort of operators are scaling and growing, and maybe they're starting to have somebody on their team who's responsible for this, but maybe trying to get up to speed and identify their risks and understand what their options are. Mm-hmm. You can help with that education process and a solution set, obviously. But right. Even understanding all of the risk. I know cybersecurity is a big topic that we're about to jump in and start covering, because I think, to your point, a lot of folks don't think about it until they've had a bad experience and they've suffered from it. So trying to get out in front of some of those things.
Yeah, the best way to not have to worry about safeguarding high value data, or as you upgrade systems in the future, meaning your actual equipment that you have on site, is to not store it in the first place.
Exactly. Right. So just give the risk to you, basically. Hand it over off the plate for sure.
Yeah.
Great. So that's the case with you, and then the cybersecurity piece, and I won't get into that now, but same thing. There are vendors that are saying, look, we'll just handle the whole thing. So you can stop worrying about that, and it's not in your building and on your plate. We own it. Sort of transaction, if you will. And they have all of the experts and the secure technology to manage that.
You know, everyone who's providing an ongoing commercial service of any high value data warehousing is continually upgrading and reinvesting in their systems to keep up with best practices. Whatever the latest protocols are, they're deploying that as a risk mitigation practice. So that's a whole different bucket of expertise than running a space.
For exactly. And not necessarily fun and enjoyable and exciting one path to have to grow your expertise around. So I know I prefer to leave that to the experts that think about those things all day and night. So if somebody wants to understand more about how PlacePay works and have a conversation with you, what's the best way to do that?
jack@placepay.com.
That's easy. Or they could come to the conference. But if they're anxious
to talk to you
before then, email Jack. And then if you want to meet him in person, he will be at the GWA conference in September in Washington, D.C., which we're super excited about. Jack, thank you for sharing today. This has been super helpful for you to kind of share the workflow and the case study and help us understand a little bit more about, you know, sort of how this works, and even to talk about some of the things I hadn't thought a lot about, sort of the compliance and data security as part of this process. So I appreciate you sharing. And if anybody has questions, certainly email Jack, throw him in the Facebook group. We'll get Jack to respond. He's super helpful. We appreciate everything you give to the industry. So good. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jack. And we'll let you get back to your Tuesday.
Thanks, Jamie. And I really appreciate you having me on. It continues to be a pleasure working with you and the GWA and the rest of the industry. It's just a joy all around.
Excellent. Likewise. Thank you again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.